You are listening to the Holistic Hormone Podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor Dooley, and if you're seeking a deeper understanding of your body's inner workings, the reasons behind its actions and reactions, and you suspect that your hormones might be at play, you are in the right place, my friend. As a functional medicine nutritionist specializing in holistic hormone health for women, I bring together the latest research, my clinical expertise, and my own personal experiences to create a safe space for you to learn and explore. Just remember, this podcast provides information and inspiration for you, not medical diagnoses or treatments. Always consult your own doctor before making any changes. Now, are you ready to dive in? Let's get started. Welcome to the Holistic Hormone Podcast. I'm Eleanor Dooley, your host. And today I have a special treat for you. A good friend of mine, Denise Caperso, is here with us today, and she's going to share with us some of the things that she helps people with. She's been a licensed social worker since 1997, and the majority of her career was in the nonprofit sector, helping people find safe housing and healing from trauma. Now she has a private practice, and her specialty is helping women heal from narcissistic abuse. So welcome, Denise. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for having me. And I get to talk about my favorite topic.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about you and how you got into this specific, I'm sure everybody's ears perked up when I said, women healing from narcissistic abuse. I know that it has become more of a mainstream term recently, at least in my circles, but can you just explain what that is and then how you kind of, help people? How does it work?
Right. So I always say narcissistic behaviors are on a continuum from a little bit of narcissistic behaviors to full-blown malignant narcissism. So the term is thrown around quite a bit. Not everybody meets the DSM-5 diagnostic criteria for narcissism, but I help women figure that out a little bit. Mostly, they feel that there's an imbalance of power in the relationship. That's the number one thing that they're feeling, which leads to a whole slew of conditions, anxiety, depression, and health issues, which we'll get into. But my career started right out of the gate after my master's degree. I started working for CPS. So trauma from day one, the get-go. Obviously, everybody involved in CPS, the whole family is experiencing trauma. And then I moved on to different settings. But the most recent community agency that I worked in was Hope Store New Beginning Center in Plano. And it was there. I worked there for 3 years that I really learned so much about intimate partner violence and specifically narcissistic abuse in relationships and what that looks like.
Yeah. And how, I mean, obviously when I hear stories about it or I hear people talking about it and, my little spidey sense goes off and goes, oh my gosh, it sounds like you're being manipulated, or it sounds like, things aren't right, but you're being told that they're not a big deal or things like that. Like, how do you help women identify that this is even happening? Because I know there's a lot of denial. There's probably a lot of gaslighting. Can you explain what that is, what gaslighting is? That's another term that's like super popular now. And I just want to be super clear and get it, from basically you are the person that is practicing it. You are trained in this. And it's not, nothing against TikTok, but there's a lot of social media doctors out there diagnosing people and things like that. And I think there's a lot of confusion. So can you just take a few minutes and kind of explain what it actually is and how would you know?
So when women call me or show up in my office, what they tend to say they're experiencing is high levels of anxiety and depression in their marriage. They feel confused. They don't know how to make decisions on their own. They feel like they're always second guessing themselves. And they feel like they don't have any power in the relationship. Oftentimes that looks like very scared feeling, or like their fight or flight sense is always on. They rarely come in and say, I think I'm married to a narcissist. Or a lot of times they'll say, my husband is telling me I'm a narcissist. Am I? So gaslighting, we hear that term a lot now. And what it really means is when your spouse makes you feel like you're questioning your reality, they'll do things like deny things that incidences, they'll say that never happened, or I never said that, or you're remembering this wrong. And over a period of years or decades, with that constant feedback from the spouse, the women, I'm going to use women because most of my clients are women, I'd say 95%. The women start to not trust their own judgment or trust reality of things because their partner is always telling them, no, that's not right. You didn't remember that right. That never happened.
And to me, even you just describing that gives me this like cringy feeling in my body. And I'm hoping that's my nervous system reacting to a situation where it does make you question of like, well, maybe I did misremember it, or maybe I'm getting worked up about something I shouldn't get worked up about. Those kinds of confusion that you're speaking to. What have you seen over the years of, I'm sure you've seen different stages of this as far as how, like you said, decades, it could be, many, many years. Just the long-term effects on, I guess, a woman's psyche, her self-esteem, and her ability to even claim power in relationships, not just marriage, but with work, with friends, that kind of thing.
It's interesting because a lot of my clients are very successful at work and in outside relationships. Not all, but it's just in this particular dynamic of the marriage that they're not, or they feel like they're disempowered. Most of the time, once they get to my office and I meet with them, 9 times out of 10, we figure out one of their parents or caregivers, primary caregivers as a child, was a narcissist. So they were kind of conditioned as at a young age to have a high tolerance for bad behavior, abusive behavior that pushes their boundaries or makes them feel small. So when they go out and start dating, it's like their nervous system, when they meet someone that's a narcissist, their nervous system connects with that person's and it feels like, oh, this feels
It's
familiar. This feels like
familiar.
home, right?
Yeah.
And that's really hard to pull that apart in the beginning stages because it's kind of like that instant attraction, right? But really, it's that nervous system feeling of, oh, this feels really familiar to me and normal. I like it.
Yeah. So, what is your take on it feeling normal and I like it, even though I know it's? I'm going to use the word bad. It's not right. It's not safe, but there's comfort in safety in toxicity. What is your take on that?
So typically, okay, if you're in a relationship, if you're a young child and one of your parents is a narcissist, right? Typically, the household growing up is pretty chaotic. So you're very used to walking on eggshells. And it's almost, at a very young age, it's imprinted on you that this dynamic between the parents, this is what love looks like. It's imprinted, right, on you. So that when you go out into the world, you're subconsciously seeking that. When you find a narcissist, typically they're so charming, so over the top, meeting every need of yours. It feels amazing. It usually lasts, I tell my clients, about 45 days, 3 to 4 months. Usually that's what happens. And then they slowly, slowly start pushing your boundaries or showing their narcissistic traits. Their nervous system is like, oh, this doesn't feel that crazy. I felt this before. I know love is supposed to feel chaotic. It's okay. I'll stick around. I'm not going to make any big changes. And so that slowly begins to happen over time, where the narcissistic behaviors just become more and more and more.
And I imagine it's super terrifying to go, I know this doesn't feel right, but I don't know what else is out there. At least I kind of understand this chaos. Mm-hmm. So I can, you know, hang out here. But I guess the tipping point from what you were saying is it like anxiety and, you know, depression and these feelings that become so overwhelming, not only like in our reality, but like in our nervous system and in our, like our body's ability to function. Is that typically where you kind of see people at their breaking point and they're like, okay, something has to change. I don't know what.
I don't know. I want to say sadly, I'm not sure that's the right word, but typically if it's their own anxiety and depression, it's not enough for them to say, I'm ready to get out. It's when they start seeing it in the kids. When they start seeing their kids exhibit fear, anxiety, or depression around the spouse, that they're like, oh gosh, now I really have to do something. I'm kind of being forced to do something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's so right. Similarly, in an unfortunate similarity would be something like domestic abuse. I've heard stories of women can put up with things if it's with them, but if it moves beyond that, that's when they are compelled to take action, which is very, to me, so sad that women are not able to necessarily put themselves in a safe position as well as wanting to do that.
Not all narcissists are physically abusive, but all physically abusive people tend to be narcissists. I see in a couple cases I have right now, there could have been no physical violence for 10 to 15 years, but recently there have been incidents where someone was pushed or shoved or held against the wall, right? The cycle of abuse comes back. The narcissist says, I'm sorry, I will never, ever, ever do that again. I promise it won't happen. But once that boundary is pushed, right? Once that physical boundary is pushed and the woman does not take a stand, the narcissist thinks, I can do that again, right? There was
if they promise to high heaven, it doesn't matter. Right?
Because they've already done it once and there was no consequences, or the consequences were really minimal. Nothing that impacted their life in a significant way.
Where do you think like narcissism comes from? I know we get modeled it from parents, whatever, teachers, people that raised us. Is there any other outside influences, you think?
Well, there is some studies now that it is genetic. There's a genetic code for it. But I think it's also really about environment and your primary caregivers. So I think there's two theories. One is that the child that is really overindulged from a young age, the child is made to think they are the greatest, they deserve everything. They're kind of pushing this entitlement. You know, everything you ask for, you're going to get. We will change our schedules for you. We'll make way, you know, we'll do whatever. You're on a throne. We see this a lot in cultural dynamics, too, with the oldest son.
I was going to say only child or
only child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or oldest son. Interesting. Oldest
son. Yeah.
That's because I, you know, I often think of like, you know, these uber rich celebrities that don't know any hardships, right? They just don't understand the reality of a regular person, so to speak, and how they learn life skills.
The other extreme is a child who is completely abandoned and then takes on the world view of, I need to do whatever I need to do to get my needs met. And people are just pieces that I'm moving around to get my needs met. It's a survival mechanism.
Interesting. And what is the correlation, if any, with alcoholism? I know that comes into some of your practice. And
so people who are in active addiction, whether it's alcohol, drugs, whatever, they tend to have narcissistic behaviors, because their daily life is all about when I'm going to drink next, when I'm going to use next. And everybody else is ancillary, right? So they're very driven by my need, my need, my need all day long. Sometimes when they go to treatment and you take that away, then you see a much different, kind, loving person. So
they feed each other, alcoholism and narcissism,
yeah,
in a way?
Yeah, because usually addiction is formed in adolescence and you get stuck in that adolescent phase. So you might be 30, 40, 50, but you're thinking and acting like a 15-year-old, which is the world revolves around me. I need to get what I need. And then I'll think about you.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a few friends of mine, their spouses, when they come to me with their dynamics and he said this, and then we did that. And I'm like, oh my goodness, that sounds like the person is a child. They're having a tantrum. They're making fun of you. You know, they're doing these sort of childish things to divert to actually solving a problem or actually showing vulnerability or whatever that is. And I can definitely see, now that you're saying that, the ways they revert to, you know, their, I guess, emotional intelligence, their developmental maturity of making decisions and relationships with people.
They've never developed adult healthy coping skills. So you'll see them revert to toddler-like behavior, adolescent behavior, just like you're saying, temper tantrums, running away, acting out, breaking things. All, you know, just avoiding in general.
And how do you, obviously in your therapy practice, you walk mostly women through coping, through healing. How do it, you know, generally, how do you unravel this, get the person to see what's happening and then rebuild? Like, what does that look like?
Generally, in the beginning, it's a lot of checking in with them and just providing a safe space for them to talk, because they don't really have that. They don't have it in their marriage, but they don't have it really in their support systems either, because a lot of times anyone outside the marriage will see the narcissist in a different light. Oh, he's a great provider. Oh,
yep.
Look at him. He's the coach.
He's so charming. He's so
what
funny.
A great guy. Yeah,
yeah,
so sweet.
Life of the party.
They don't see the other side at all. And what the wife tries to say, oh, sometimes he acts like, you know, they're like, really? I can't even imagine that. So kind of having a safe space to talk is really important. And them to, there, I can hear them, see them asking themselves, can these two things both exist at once, right? I have this guy who acts like this to the community outside, right? Is that really him? Or is the person I see at home belittling, you know, physically pushing my boundaries, sexually pushing my boundaries?
Disrespect.
Disrespect. Or is that really him? What, am I crazy? Could these two exist at the same time? Like, what's real and what's not real? So
yeah.
It's kind of helping them pull that apart a little bit. What's real and what's not real?
And so you're saying both of those things can be and usually are real.
Well, the outside, the people who see them on the outside is that narcissist carrying that mask. That mask, right, is pretend, right? So that person that you see that shows up nice, kind, sometimes love bombing after a fight, trying to reel you back in, that is fake.
Fake.
That is pretend version. The real person is the person that you see at home.
And how do, so... Okay, so let's say we've identified, okay, he's definitely that, right? Mm-hmm. And his real nature is, how does somebody repair from something like that?
It takes a very long time. Okay. It could take, depending on how often the client comes in and how often we work together. Part of my job is to get them to start seeing life through the narcissistic lens, because most of the women think, I can get him to think like me. I can get him to change. I can get him to see things differently. That narcissistic lens is not moving, right? It is I need to get my needs met at all costs. People, again, are just pawns that I move around to get what I need. There's no changing that.
Yeah. Do you believe narcissists can change if they want help?
So the key factor of narcissism is they don't have any insight into their own behaviors.
Yeah.
And they are a victim. So in order for someone to change in therapy, they have to be able to say, oh gosh, you know, I have these flaws, or I did this and it really hurt somebody else. Sometimes people with just a little bit of narcissistic behaviors can change because they do have empathy and insight. But once you get, you know, up on that sliding, you know, whatever, what do I call it? Timeline? Yeah. Scale, like, no, they can't. They just don't have the ability.
They don't have the empathy. They've never developed that muscle, so to speak.
And you cannot teach it to someone who doesn't have any capacity for it. So getting the women to understand this is their view, and their view is never going to change no matter how you act, how much you forgive them.
How perfect you are.
It's never, ever going to change.
And there will never be they will never be satisfied. So if they're upset about how dirty the house is, and now the house is perfectly clean, there will be something else that they're not happy with, right?
Right. So if they start acting kind, right, or nice, or put on that facade, it's usually because they want something, right? And as soon as
because it's their needs.
That's their needs. As soon as they get what they want, no need to be nice anymore. I'm going to ditch that mask.
Gosh, both sides of that seem exhausting.
It is so exhausting. It is so exhausting. And that takes a toll on the body, the physical body.
And that's kind of where I'm coming in and seeing women, you know, I'm stressed out. I've got all this anxiety, and, you know, I look at hormones and gut and functional blood work, and they're telling me that all of these things about their husband. I'm like, you need to talk to my friend Denise, like, because, the fight or flight, which you mentioned at the very beginning, was, your nervous system is not designed to be in fight or flight for longer than a few minutes, right? And if you think about our animalistic nature, you know, a cheetah running in the wild, right? Chasing its prey. But then it gets its prey and then it sleeps for like a day, right? Mm-hmm. Like our bodies are designed to shut down at night, regroup, and then show up for the next day. But in I'd say our generation and later, most of that goes out the window. I mean, people are workaholics. It's applauded. If you have to work all night, you have to work all weekend. Like that's like, ooh, wow, you're really doing it, instead of going, I need to take care of myself. Because, you know, you and I both know the cycle of, I'm physically tired, and now I'm mentally exhausted, and now that's making me physically more tired, and just this spiral.
There was a meme going around, or I talked about it with some colleagues, or it's if you see a woman who is doing a million things, you know, running the PTA, doing this, doing that, coaching, constantly running the kids around, like doing everything, and you're like, wow, how does she do it? That's a trauma response. That is a trauma response. That constant go, 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 I cannot rest is a trauma response, maybe from something earlier in childhood. And often when I see people who have had child abuse or neglect from childhood, and then they marry a narcissist, right? And it goes on, that decades of the fight or flight response comes out like an autoimmune disease, right? So we'll see a lot of chronic fatigue, or gut stuff showing up, hair falling out, all of those autoimmune, like there's no, you know, diagnosis for, but.
And it's unfortunate that we're trained to think there's something wrong with our body, right? Because people come in and with a story such as something that you said, and I'm like, oh, you've spent 40 years in a trauma response, and you would like a pill for me to heal this tissue damage or organ damage. And, you know, we say it kind of jokingly, but honestly, it, just the awareness alone of people like you and I just talking about it, of like, it's a thing. We help women heal from this. We help women through it, because our hope is that we provide resources that they don't know that are there. They've never been able to find. Maybe they're financially out of reach. I know in your past, you said that you worked with a lot of disadvantaged women in those kinds of situations. Do you have any, you know, pearls from that experience, or notice any trends?
The trends that I notice, no matter what the socioeconomic level is that these women are so checked out from their bodies, their physical bodies. They are not in tune with their body at all. If something is telling them, if their stomach is like, you know, anxious, or they have that anxious feeling, they'll just have it for decades, right? They're not like, oh, wow, I need to do something about this.
Yeah, because you don't go from nothing to extreme pain, unless it's an acute, you know, reaction or infection. It's a slow burn.
Right. So whether it was in the shelter, when I was in the shelters, or just in my private practice now, I often refer to some sort of yoga, like yin yoga, somatic yoga. They need to get back in touch with their physical body and start really listening to what the body is saying.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned yoga. What other healing modalities do you either refer out or just recommend for, you know, women just who realized, oh my gosh, my marriage is in a state of disrepair. I'm not prepared to get up and go. There's kids involved, what have you. Where do they start?
Often what I start doing with them is building a support system outside of the house and start incorporating self-care. Now, a lot of people think self-care is like, I'll just get my nails done, or I'll go to the hairdresser.
Bubble bath.
Right. And a bubble bath and the hairdresser can be self-care if you think about it in terms of someone is touching me and applying warm heat, right? That is really helping my nervous system settle. Or a warm bath, right? What does that feel like on the body? What is the temperature doing to you, right? What's that sensory feeling? Okay, it has a calming effect. So really being plugged in and mindful of, I need to calm my body through the five senses, right? It's not about just getting your nails done. Maybe it's about someone just taking the time to massage your hands and really feeling that and tuning into that.
That's so interesting. You just made me kind of like go, oh my goodness. Years ago, I had a membership to like Massage Envy, and I'd go once a month and I loved it, right? I mean, who wouldn't love a massage? But for years, I was just like, oh yeah, it's just massage, whatever. It's an hour. Like, oh, 60 minutes is over. Great. Right. And I never connected to, oh, this is time for me to think, to allow my body to, you know, enjoy, like you said, the sensations and things. And, I just didn't grow up with, physical emotion, or even outward, emotion of love and connection. And so it's foreign to me.
Yeah. And good massage therapists, I often refer to massage therapists, really have the client, tune into the breath in the beginning of the massage, the breathing, and then they'll check in at different points. Okay. Let's remember your breathing, right? And how to utilize breath work during massage. It's so important. It's not just this, this frivolous thing that I'm going to go do, right?
Yeah.
You have to be mindful about.
I never thought about it that way, because you're right. So you could take the bubble bath example of like, yeah, it's a bath. There's like, I hear kids running around in the background. I know I need to do all the stuff when I get out. The bathroom's going to be all wet. I got to find another towel. Where's the towel? Like, it could be that, or it could be, oh, these sensations are, you know, calming my muscles, and, you know, the Epsom salts are absorbing into my body, and same reaction, right? Two completely different outcomes for your nervous system.
And if you can incorporate more of the senses, right? Of like, you know, what kind of sponge are you using on your skin? What kind of scent is coming from the bathtub? What are you listening to? the more you can incorporate all five senses, the better to, you know, relax the nervous system.
Yeah. And you can take this into anything, because you could do a yoga class that's completely healing and restorative. And you could do a yoga class where the whole time you're just like, oh my gosh, when is it going to be over? This guy next to me, I can't stand him. Oh my gosh, the instructor's too loud, right? Yep. Same class, exactly. Same experience, two people next to each other, two having two totally different experiences. So let's not gaslight ourselves into, I have to do self-care right. And going, I get to do self-care to allow my body this downtime and relaxing of my nervous system. Because if I do not, eventually your physical body will take over, not in a good way.
And so what's happening with my clients and some of yours, right, is if it is very hard to relax the body if you're constantly in protective mode. And so these women, I always say they have antenna, right? Their antenna is constantly searching for cues from the environment. Am I safe? Am I not safe? Are my kids safe? Are they not safe? Right? If you're constantly in protective mode, fight or flight, very hard to relax.
Yeah. And so you said this, the first step is getting people to be, first of all, the self-awareness of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm sure it sounds like there would be a big step of, I can't waste time on that for myself.
Right.
It's getting them to see that it's not wasting time, first of all, and you are important too.
Yeah,
right.
That's a little, someone on Instagram, I'll have them follow, and it's like 2 minutes in the morning, you know, of somatic yoga, like really easy. I'm like, you have time for this. You have time for 2 minutes.
Nice. I love that. And my practice too. I'm like, you have time to make a 30 second, you know, egg. You have time to eat a hard boiled egg, right? So, or even worse, you have time to go to the bathroom, right? Mm-hmm. You have time. So, and I'm sure there are mini minuscule baby steps at first. And so how long does somebody work with you? I mean, I'm sure they could be ongoing, but you know, when they really kind of get their feet back under them, I mean, does it vary with every single person, or do you see, you know, steps in healing?
I mean, it really varies, and it really depends on their trauma history, right?
Yeah.
So if there's not a lot of trauma history, you know, I have women come to me at all different points. One is I'm dating someone. One is I've been married 5 years. Okay, now I'm married 17 years. Okay, now I'm separated from the narcissist. Now I'm post-divorce. It's still affecting my life. What do I do? So, you know, I have clients come that just need coaching on how do I co-parent with this guy, you know, and it's just strictly coaching. We're not going back into past trauma or anything like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Can you describe your practice a little bit? Because I know you do life coaching, you just said, but that's separate from the therapy. Is there, can you just describe how somebody would call you, and do they have to live in Texas? Like, who do you see?
So I see people from all over the state for therapy. So therapy, my license kind of is, I can only do mental health trauma therapy in Texas. And so that is for people, again, who've had childhood trauma and or this relationship is just highly traumatic and they have to process a lot of these heavy, heavy feelings, a lot of emotion connected. And I am trained in different trauma modalities to help speed that process up, because we're not in the age anymore where someone's going to go to therapy for 5 years, 8 years. Like, yeah. No one wants to do that. And no one has the time either.
Well, so tell, before you go on, tell us a little about that. How do you speed up therapy? What's that?
So there's different modalities that, you know, I'm trained in, that a lot of trauma therapists use, like brain spotting, EMDR, ART, that just accelerates the process. So instead of going to therapy for a year or two, you could go for 6 months and get the same amount, get the same results that you would if you were just going to regular talk therapy for a few years.
Yes. And that's what's so curious to me. So, you know, traditional therapy that we think about, talk therapy, you sit and you kind of process and formulate language around your emotions and your experience, and then you're validated, and then you talk about what to do. That's my interpretation anyway. And these modalities, the EMDR. I know that's the eye movement one,
Right.
Yeah. So what are these doing? They're like rewiring your brain in some capacity.
It's recoding the memories that you have. So a lot of people have traumatic memories that affect their daily life, maybe affect their sex life, or maybe affect just feeling safe in public, right? These core memories that they can't get out of their head, or they constantly come up in dreams. And so EMDR and art and brain spotting helps go back and kind of recode the memory so that you have the memory, but you don't have the emotions and sensations attached to that memory anymore.
Yeah. And that's similarly what I do with what's called NLP or neuro-linguistic programming, which I also offer, but yours is such you've got a lot of things to kind of choose from in your toolkit that I think offers such a unique experience for somebody who feels that helplessness and that just so disempowered and, you know, oh, there's nothing, what can I do? I'm trapped. Right. And I just think that that's such a valuable resource. So, so you can help women, you said all over Texas. Do you do virtual then and in person?
Yeah. And I can do trauma therapy virtually. I just want to give a small example. One of the women I was working with recently had childhood trauma that really affected her ability to feel safe. And so we had that core memory. We went in and worked on it. And part of it, you know, is they're able to go in and help that younger version of themselves and change and reprogram the memory, right? So in this memory, she was stuck as a child, really getting abused. And she was able to lift herself out of that memory, almost like she had this ability to fly as a child, right?
Yeah.
And since that time, since we've reprocessed that, she's like, I never have that nightmare anymore.
Wow.
You know, I don't feel those feelings around that memory at all. So it's really, really impactful.
Yeah. It's to piggyback off of that example. Even in my own experience of, you know, you remember it, we're not erasing fear, right? You have to have the ability to feel fear to keep yourself safe, right? If someone, you hear something in the middle of the night, you want to be able to be prepared to take care of it, right?
Yeah.
So what we're doing is actually revisiting the memory, that younger version of yourself, and saying, guess how old I am now? Guess how resourced I am now?
Right.
And I have the ability to control this situation now, even though at the time I did not.
Exactly.
And it's as simple as that, you guys. Like, it's not brain surgery, essentially, right? That's kind of what the picture is painted. It's, oh my gosh, it's all of the, it's not. And it's really tapping into that unconscious mind, which is the soundtrack that repeats, that tells you the good things about yourself, but most likely the bad things, right? Yeah. For some reason, the soundtrack in our head is all the bad things we don't like. Why can't we just say good things to ourselves? I want that reprogramming, right? And it's a lot of digging and it's a lot of healing, but
I like to tell my clients trauma therapy is very empowering, right? Because they're like, oh, trauma therapy, I do not want to do that. I don't want to touch that with the 10-foot pole, right?
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to find. That's right. What some people say to me. Mm-hmm. Even with my own therapist, that, you know, the day of the consult, I see it on the calendar and I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that today. But I always show up and I go, I don't want to be here. I'm just letting you know. It's not the fun stuff. But obviously after, you know, the processing and the dreams improve. Oh my gosh. And your outlook on your situation changes. Now the people around you don't necessarily change, right?
Right.
The shitty comments from the people, that those don't change, but you do. And I think we spend so much of our lives hoping and wishing and praying that the other person will change.
Yeah. And it's all about you changing.
Yeah. And the modality that you offer is a way out that works and that helps people, and it empowers women to take control of situations that they have been marginalized, they've been taken advantage of, they've been manipulated, and it has to stop. And this is how we stop it.
Yep.
This education.
The other thing that I offer is the coaching. And so the coaching piece is more of what's happening now moving forward, right? So mostly what my coaching focuses on is helping people co-parent with a narcissist and setting boundaries and keeping those boundaries, empowering them to keep the boundaries. And if they're married to an alcoholic, same thing. It's setting these boundaries and rediscovering who they are outside of being this wife and partner to someone abusing substances.
And you can help anybody with that. Mm-hmm. There's no location.
Oh, and that's across all 50 states. Yep.
Wow. Well, we are so grateful that you do this and you help women. And I think you and I connected over our, you know, joint mission to mm-hmm. empower women and to not, you know, stand for, you know, behaviors that are not, not empowering other people, and especially women. So we appreciate you so much. Tell us how people can contact you. I will definitely put your website in the show notes, or do you prefer email, or how do people find you?
So my website is dccounseling.org, and you know, I'll give you all the links to Instagram and my Facebook page. I'm in the process of consolidating my website, so it'll all be under one website, all the services I offer. Hopefully that will be ready this first week of July.
Oh, good. Good. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. I know the women out there listening, there's a ray of hope, right? When sometimes they don't see it. So, I'm grateful for you, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for tuning in to the Holistic Hormone Podcast. I appreciate you being part of our community, and I hope you found today's episode truly valuable. If this podcast meant something to you and you'd like to show your support, please consider leaving me a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Your reviews help others discover this valuable information. Don't forget to stay connected with me on social media. You can always find me on Instagram at holistic.hormone.specialist, where I share insights, tips, and updates to keep you informed and inspired. And if you're interested in exploring my latest programs and resources, head over to nourishingnutrition.net to see what's new and how you can further your journey to holistic hormone health. Once again, thanks for being part of this podcast family. Your health and well-being matter, and I'm here to support you every step of the way. Until next time, take care and stay hormonally balanced.